the financial impact of living in rural Alaska, I think, is beginning to have a stress and a strain.
Schools in the bush struggle with falling enrollment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 24th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Catholic Church confronts the priest shortage in rural Alaska.
The number of priests in our diocese has gone from 47, roughly about a priest a parish, down to 17.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You can prevent costly damage to the environment with an inspection of heating equipment and fuel oil tanks. Spills can contaminate drinking water and stormwater drains, which can cause health problems for people and animals. Technical assistance is available online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link for assistance to the Home Heating Oil webpage. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
The jury that will decide the fate of Senator Ted Stevens has been chosen. Today, 16 people, 12 jurors, and 4 alternates were selected in U.S. District Court. The jurors won't find out until the end of the trial who the alternates are. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The 16 residents of the District of Columbia will decide whether Stevens is guilty of lying on his Senate financial disclosure forms. Some of the jurors had never heard of the senator, a big difference from Alaska, where Stevens wanted the trial moved. There are 9 African-American women, 3 African-American men, 1 Hispanic man, and only 3 white jurors, 2 women and 1 man. That's also a change from Alaska, where less than 4% of the population is black. Among the jurors' ranks are a third-grade schoolteacher, an employee of the Navy, a man who works in drug rehabilitation, a bookkeeper for the D.C. National Guard, and a woman who compiles data on wiretaps. Government prosecutors plan to play wiretapped conversations during the trial, but the juror said she had no experience conducting wiretaps and only worked with statistics about them. Half of the group has served on juries before, and half have family or friends in law enforcement. That question came up because numerous law enforcement officers, like FBI agents, are expected to testify. Jury selection wrapped up Wednesday afternoon after a day and a half spent screening people. 66 were questioned by the judge and lawyers about their ability to be fair and impartial. 36 of them were found fit to serve. Senator Stevens attended jury selection, arriving Wednesday morning with his lawyers in a white van with dark windows that pulled right up to the courthouse entrance. He walked in with one of his daughters. The senator listened to the jury selection process and sat with his lawyers as they pored over the jury paperwork and decided who they would bump. The defense team was allowed to dismiss a dozen jurors, and the government could call 8, all without cause. Among those, the judge said were qualified to serve but were bumped by either the defense or prosecution, an employee of telecom company Verizon, who has worked with one of Stevens' former top aides, a volunteer with the American Civil Liberties Union, and a security guard at the courthouse. After the jury went home, the court still had work to do. Stevens' lawyers are pushing for access to information about the company that bought Veeco, CH2M Hill. They want to know if Veeco CEO Bill Allen was given a promise by the government that the company would be protected from prosecution if he became a witness. Lawyers for CH2M Hill don't want to turn the information over. Opening statements in the trial will start Thursday morning. Each side will have about an hour and 15 minutes to lay out their case. Then the government says it plans to call 3 witnesses, including the engineer for Veeco, who designed the addition to Stevens' Girdwood home. The house renovation is among the gifts prosecutors allege Stevens lied about. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
In Nome, school administrators are discovering there are fewer students in the classroom this year. That's threatening to take a big bite out of the district's operating budget. Paul Korchin from KNOM has more.
Incoming Superintendent Rick Luthy says Nome Public Schools has turned out to be way off this time from its annual enrollment expectations.
This year's budget was based on a projected number of 731 students. We currently have 670 students, a difference of 61 students down from what our budget was based on.
Given the roughly $5,000 per student Department of Education funding formula, that could translate into about $300,000 less in state money, not an insignificant portion of the Nome District's approximately $10 million budget. In response, Luthi says the district is already tightening its fiscal belt.
What we have done at this point is we have taken a very conservative stand on our discretionary money. In other words, the money we use for ordering supplies, purchasing textbooks, those things that we can control. We're kind of holding on a lot of that right now to see what happens. We're trying to limit the amount of money we spend in overtime needs. And we also are going to begin to look at curtailing some of the travel that happens.
The big question is, where are all those anticipated students going? Luthi says no clear patterns of student migration have yet emerged, but he has a hunch.
The financial impact of living in rural Alaska, I think, is beginning to have a stress and a strain. What we're very interested in watching over the next couple weeks is what the impact of the permanent fund checks going out may have. As families get those checks, that they may use that money to move to a place that they economically feel is going to be healthy for them.
Whether that means moving into Nome or out of it remains to be seen. Anchorage and Fairbanks schools are already reporting higher than expected enrollments this year. Luthi indicates district jobs are not yet on the chopping block, but whether that becomes necessary will depend upon if the state allows NPS a budgetary hold harmless option.
If we do not qualify for that and we have to readjust our budget to make up for a pretty good size loss, at some point we will probably have to look at positions. I don't think we can make up the dollars that we may have to and not at some point impact positions. We hope to not do that.
This year's official student count will be done by October 24th. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
School districts around Prince William Sound also have fewer students in attendance. Cordova, Copper Basin, and Valdez have all lost K-12 students. In Copper Basin, Superintendent James Elliott says it's no secret where the kids are going.
You know, in Anchorage's case, their enrollment's up, I think, about 400 this year. And from the data they've been able to gather, they believe that it's a result of people moving in from rural areas into Anchorage where the costs are less. And I think that that bears out my experience, too. This is my 45th year in Alaska, and I've seen similar trends over the years. It's very expensive to live in Alaska, but now with the cost of fuel, both gas and heating oil, people are having a tough time.
The low enrollment numbers have many schools facing potential budget shortfalls. In Valdez, Superintendent Lance Bowie says the school district has had to lay off two staff members, including a part-time instructor. Bowie says he just returned from the Association of Alaska School Boards conference, where the talk from educators around the state was pretty much unanimous. Energy prices are driving heating bills up and school funding down.
You know, you don't heat half of a room, or you don't turn off half the lights because you have half the students in there. And the cost of our personnel remain the same. In the world of education, 83 to 87% of your cost of personnel. And you still have to educate those kids that you have and maintain the same kind of programs if you want to be a competitive institution.
Over the last 5 years, Bowie says Valdez has lost 170 students. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskan writers tackle their environment.
That sense of a deep and abiding respect for and love for one's place.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
The oil industry is still interested in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska. A lease sale today pulled in $31 million in high bids, most of it for land that has been offered for lease before. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Officials at the Bureau of Land Management seem pleased at the amount of industry interest in NPRA. Many of the tracts are nowhere near any pipeline, but the bids keep coming. It was no surprise to see ConocoPhillips add to areas it has already leased to the west of Nuiqsut. These are adjacent to leases that could link to its Alpine field. But eyebrows were definitely raised by the way Petro Hunt made an assertive play deep within the reserve. Owned by the legendary Hunt family, the company bid like it expects to find gas along the Ipikpuk River and between there and Umiat on the Colville. Also interested there is FEX. Petro Hunt laid down the biggest bid of the sale for an Ipikpuk tract, almost $643,000. It also laid down near $500,000 bids for other tracts in the same area. The total of high bids in this sale was well below the $53 million bid by the industry for the same area in 2004. That sale showed great interest in the area near Teshikpuk Lake, and the Bush administration tried to open additional acreage near the lake but was rebuffed by the courts and ended up removing most of those tracts from this year's sale. Along with FEX, Anadarko bid on a number of the NPRA tracts, also Petro-Canada. The federal government splits the lease bids with the state government, so Alaska made $15 million from the sale. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Federal officials are telling Tongass forest managers to provide more cost-effective timber sales that includes 10-year harvest contracts. The direction comes as part of top-level approval of the latest Tongass management plan, but that plan is being challenged in court by industry backers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The latest version of the Tongass National Forests Management Plan had to clear one final hurdle before it could take effect. That was approval from U.S. Department of Agriculture Undersecretary Mark Ray. Ray gave the go-ahead last week, but with conditions. Most call for Tongass managers to come up with timber sales that cost less to plan, cut, and move. That includes four 10-year sales, each providing 15 to 20 million board feet a year. Forrest Cole, Tongass Forest Supervisor, says he'll draw up a budget for the sales as he's been instructed, but he says they may not generate the predictable supply the industry wants.
Throwing a lot of volume into a few sales rather than having a multitude of smaller sales has been problematic for us. And if we get litigated on one large sale, it has a tendency to tie up a significant amount of volume with one case. In comparison, having a lot of smaller sales, the economics of doing those types of sales is more difficult, but it gives us more flexibility in being able to maintain projects that are not tied up in litigation.
Cole says the 10-year sales will be in addition to existing harvest plans. They will be in areas of the forest near mills in Wrangell, Klowock, and Ketchikan. One of the Tongass plan's biggest critics is the Southeast Conference, which wants more timber made available faster and with fewer costs. The regional organization made one of 15 appeals to the Tongass management document. When they were overruled, the conference asked Undersecretary Ray to make changes. Conference Timber Committee member Dennis Watson, also Craig's mayor, says Ray's instructions are a step in the right direction.
We believe that it would bring stability to the industry. You know, that right now it is so hit and miss on a timber sale. You know, they have to be able to finance the improvements to their operations and have a business plan over a number of years. And it's pretty hard to do it if you don't have any consistency. And this certainly would be the best route to get there that we know of anyway.
But the conference is still challenging the plan in court, saying it illegally reduces the amount of timber needed to support loggers and mills. Timber Committee Chairman J.C. Conley says Ray's instructions appear to address its concerns, but the group, joined by the cities of Ketchikan, Craig, Wrangell, and Juneau, wants a judge to agree and issue an injunction forcing changes. Forest Supervisor Cole says legal action is a dangerous step that could shut down logging and the entire industry. The changes Ray ordered are also being criticized by environmental groups. Buck Lindekugel of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council says long-term timber sales and larger cuts are a step backward for the Tongass.
After 50 years of industrial-scale logging on the forest, the industry wants more economical timber, and the fact is they cut the best already, and it's not there anymore. And the timber that remains is important for other uses, whether that's providing important stream habitat for our salmon, for the deer, and our growing recreational and tourism industry. the forest has to support all those things, and I don't think it's necessarily equitable that the industry wants to get more at this stage.
Ray's instructions tell forest managers to work with the Tongass Futures Roundtable, representing a diverse group of interests, to come up with solutions. Forest Supervisor Cole says that's part of his plan. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The Catholic Church is trying to address a priest shortage that's hitting hard in its rural Alaska parishes. The Fairbanks Catholic Diocese, which oversees churches in northern and western Alaska, will send all Fairbanks area priests, including Bishop Donald Kettler, to serve Mass in villages next month. Diocese spokesman Robert Hannon says the move is a first step at recognizing one of the largest challenges the church is facing.
In the last 25 years, the number of priests in our diocese has gone from 47, roughly about a priest a parish, down to 17. And if trends continue, of course, we'll see even fewer priests.
Hannon says the decline follows a trend that extends well beyond Alaska, but its impacts are great in the state's isolated villages. Hannon says sending urban area diocese priests to bush parishes the weekend of October 4th and 5th will hopefully begin a new sharing program.
We're really looking at a sister parish relationship so that not just the priest goes out to a parish in the rural community, but the whole parish in the Fairbanks area can adopt and kind of start a long-term relationship with one of their rural cousins.
Hannon says that relationship could also include sending ministers and lecturers to villages and staging summer kids' Bible camps in rural Alaska. He says another effort aimed at addressing the priest shortage would allow Alaska Native deacons who are married to become priests.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim area has requested a special Yupik rite wherein there are married Yupik priests. Now, that's a letter endorsed by parish and regional councils all across the diocese that we would look to send to Rome.
Hannon says the exception to the priest's traditional vow of celibacy would acknowledge Yupik cultural belief that a person becomes whole only when married. Celibacy exceptions are not without precedent in the church. Hannon says married Lutheran ministers who convert to Catholicism are allowed to serve as priests. There are 20 Alaska Native deacons in western Alaska who could serve as priests if the Vatican allows.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Sitka has taken a big step forward and a small step backward in securing its energy future. The Sitka Assembly last night authorized the electric department to study a new hydro project on eastern Baranof Island. A few minutes later, they overwhelmingly declined to consider wood heat for city buildings. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The resolution on Tackett's Lake looked like any one of the two dozen or so resolutions the Assembly may consider in a year. But Utility Director Charlie Wall said the Tackett's resolution was charting a course for the future.
This is a major deal, not to me anyway. You're resolving to decrease dependence on oil, develop our renewable energy resources. That says a whole lot.
Wall said the resolution represented instructions to staff that were probably more important than the grant application itself. In today's dollars, the Tackett's Lake project would cost an estimated $200 million and effectively double Sitka's hydroelectric supply, creating a surplus that could be marketed to other communities via the proposed Southeast Electrical Intertie. That massive project didn't pencil out for Sitka when oil was selling for $20 a barrel. At $120 a barrel and beyond, what once looked unrealistic is starting to look manageable, especially for a state government flush with cash. Assemblymember Jack Osmond asked Walls if the details of the Tackett's project had changed over the last few years.
We're looking at running a power line over the mountain or putting some kind of a tunnel in, or would that be part of what the feasibility study will do for us?
That's all part of it.
Wall said that even if all the pieces fell into place, Sitka wouldn't see the project until at least 2020. The Assembly voted unanimously to pursue the grant funding. Assembly opinion about investment in wood heat, also known as biomass heat, for city-owned buildings was considerably less enthusiastic. They declined to support a resolution offering up $13,000 in local matching funds for a $60,000 reconnaissance study on the feasibility of wood-generated heat for facilities like the airport, high school, and Centennial Building. Dan Parent with the Sitka Energy Work Group, an informal committee of Forest Service, Conservation, Tribal, and other organizations interested in biomass, had prepared a detailed calculation of the amount of wood required to displace fuel oil in Sitka at a rough equivalent of one cord per 90 gallons of diesel. It amounted to over 12,000 cords per year to cover every public building, including the air station, Search, and Mount Edgecombe, plus 800 Sitka homes. Parent said it can and has been done.
This is not technology that hasn't been proven elsewhere. In the Northeast, and especially in Vermont, about 60% of the kids go to schools that are heated with wood.
Parent said that modern wood-fired heating equipment met EPA standards for air quality and would not contribute to the smoky inversions that were common in Sitka when many homes used wood stoves 20 years ago. The biggest critic on the assembly of investment in wood heat was 40-year Forest Service veteran John Sherrod. He said the current political climate made it very difficult to cut trees.
I have a strong concern about the ability of the well-meaning Forest Service in this thing to, in the social times that we're in, to be able to provide this wood fiber. It's a long way to Hoonah. Most of the good timber on the Tongass Forest is in the southern half of the forest. If we were down at Ketchikan or Craig, I'd say this might be a lot more feasible proposal.
Sherrod did not want the city to be a guinea pig and suggested leaving the exploration of biomass to the private sector. The vote was 1-6, with only Reber Stein in favor of putting up matching funds for the wood heat study. He said, at the very least, it will tell us how to do something better. At the most, it may tell us something revolutionary. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A new collection of essays and poems on Alaska's environment is just out in bookstores. Cross Currents North, Alaskans on the Environment, was inspired by the fact that there are no other anthologies written entirely by Alaskans about Alaska's environment. Mary Beth Holloman is a co-editor of the collection. She says the writers have had to have been Alaska residents for at least a decade so that those who read these works, regardless of where in the country they live, will be able to find relevance to their own lives within the pages.
That sense of a deep and abiding respect for and love for one's place. And so the connection for someone living in Florida or Texas would be their place that they are attached to, that they are rooted within, and how they love and respect and know that place in a way that you can't if you're just passing through. So I'd like to see that conveyed.
I'd really like for you to read a little bit from The Cape, your piece of work. But before you do that, I'll put you on the spot just a little bit here. Do you have favorites that really stand out to you within this work? I'm sure that you're close to all of them, having worked with them for such a long period of time, putting this together. But are there some that really stand out?
Yes, it's kind of funny. I'm the primarily the nonfiction editor, and Anne is the primarily the poetry editor, but I love poetry. I mostly write nonfiction, but some of the poems in here just blow me away every time I read them. Amy Crawford's poems, for example, Peggy Shoemaker's poems. There's such layers of meaning there. And in terms of essays, you know, it's so hard to choose. The Native Elders, I think, are very powerful. Nick Jan's essay on wolf wars is interesting because he is out there trying to collect signatures for a ballot initiative about aerial predator control. And he's very much aware of how he's stopping people in the middle of their busy day trying to get them to sign some petition. You know, that sort of discomfort that sometimes we have when we want to stand up for something we know is right, and yet we hate to bug people. I thought that was really well done in that piece.
And how about your own work? You've contributed to this as more than just an editor, as also one of the writers that's included in this.
Sure. I have two essays in here. One is about polar bears and global warming that I started the day after I heard about the first polar bear drownings, which was 4 years ago now. And the other piece I have in here is called The Cape. Okay, the section I'm going to read, it comes near the end of the essay. I'm out on this cape with my husband and son for a week. It's an island 22 miles long. No one lives on it. No one else is on it the whole time we're there. And there are no trails or anything. It's a completely wild cape. Sea lion rookeries, humpback whales, eagles, seabird rookeries, all kinds of wildlife, but no other people. Rudolf Otto, an early 20th century German philosopher, defined religion in terms of the numinous. The experience of the numinous, he said, is an awareness of the divine that clarifies our sense of our own creatureliness. He called this power, this sensation, mysterium tremendum et fascinans, a mystery awesome and entrancing. There's a desire, once such divinity is experienced, to remain in that holy light, to sustain contact with the overwhelming, to dive into the waves. But there's also a concurrent and essential awareness of our humanness. This is what grounds us even as we are filled with awe. This is what brings tears to the eyes, what makes us feel even more fully the contact of flesh and bone to rock, tree, soil, air, water. This is what I experienced on the outer rim of the Cape.
Thank you. It's an interesting thought of that connection of what we have to where we live and who we are.
Yes.
In that place.
Yeah. And the inner and the outer, you know, we experience it with our physical bodies, but we also have this inner experience with it that can be very powerful.
Mary Beth Holloman is co-editor of the new anthology Cross Currents North, Alaskans on the Environment. A reading at Tidal Wave in Anchorage is scheduled for October 21st, as well as other venues around the state. More information is available on our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Paul Korchin in Nome, Joshua Smith in Valdez, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Lack of maintenance is the primary reason heating oil tanks contaminate drinking water, sewers, and stormwater drains. Homeowners are liable under state law for the cleanup of spills from home heating oil tanks on their property. So prevent spills by arranging an inspection of tanks and heating equipment before and during the heating season. Information online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.